Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for January 3rd, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm glad to welcome you to the New Year's weekend show, our first program of this year. And each hour of each day already is history-making because of the world historic crisis in which we now find ourselves. We have both the financial breakdown to the degree of physical economic breakdown on a planetary level, and we have what you could call perpetual strife, which is part of the dying imperial system. Our topic today, in fact, is we've called it's the British Empire, you could call it the Brutish Empire, or the alternative, the case of Gaza. Now, we have to discuss this. Two people, one here with me in the studio, Michelle Steinberg. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Marcia.
Whom you know very well from both hosting the show and from her counterintelligence function with Executive Intelligence Review, and offsite nearby from the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room and editorial for the LaRouche Political Action Committee. Welcome, Leandra Bernstein.
Thank you.
Now, I say, I've said about the historical crisis we're in, I want to say right off the bat that Lyndon LaRouche has scheduled two international webcasts on that's right before and after the inauguration of President Barack Obama, and that will be by LaRouche and the Political Action Committee of his, January 16 and January 22nd. They're both at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Political Action Committee website, www.larouchepac.com. And we can say more about that. But to begin the discussion about the emergency situation that we have in the world, we ask you, Michelle, to just begin with the update and the context of it.
Well, it is a grim new year beginning, and it's a situation where the British agents who occupy the White House right now, Bush and Cheney, the Bush-Cheney administration have decided to leave a legacy of mass murder in the Middle East. And just minutes ago, as listeners probably know, if they've been monitoring their newscasts or television, about 30 minutes ago, we first received the reports that the ground invasion into the tiny Gaza Strip, where 1.5 million people, mostly young people, live under 15 years of age, under horrible conditions. It's winter. They have no fresh water. They've had no fuel for weeks and weeks and weeks. There are reports from the United Nations that families are eating off of garbage dumps, begging for food. 20,000 people as of Wednesday had no food whatsoever because of the Israeli blockade. Now the Israeli tanks are moving in. This is mass murder. And a few days ago on December 30th, Lyndon LaRouche issued a statement saying the only threat to Israel is an outbreak of peace. And what Lyndon LaRouche said is that the Israeli military attack on the Gaza Strip was an act of supreme insanity, which can lead to the destruction of Israel altogether. The idea that Israel can defeat the Palestinians by the kind of military brutality that we've seen over the past 72 hours is the height of insanity. Those are the LaRouche's words. How does he know that? Well, we saw such a foolhardy flight forward in against Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006, which went on for 34 days. And I think that there is no chance for a ceasefire unless the United States puts its foot down. And whether they slam their shoe on the table like Khrushchev did and with John F. Kennedy, whatever it is, the United States, and we can't wait for Obama, we've got to put the pressure on our own government right now. Break with the British neocolonial nightmare and tell Israel to cut it out. They can't carry out this sustained military attack without U.S. aid to replace their equipment and give them lots of money. Because like every other country in the world, Israel, maybe more than every other country in the world, Israel is facing bankruptcy. It is facing bankruptcy. It does not have an economy which can sustain the kind of war that they're going into. So pressure from the United States would be tremendous. And Lyndon LaRouche's intervention has been captured very, very well by the LIM, the LaRouche Youth Movement, who run the LaRouche Political Action Committee website and a new feature, a tremendous feature, LPAC TV. So I think we have Leandra, our colleague here, who really has carried the ball on this and can sum it up, I think.
Well, go ahead, Leandra.
Yeah, well, that's basically the situation that, as LaRouche defined in this great irony, that the only threat to Israel is the threat of peace. And what he discussed, which EIR is going to be putting out a report on, and also we're working on a report, is that the threat is the overturning of the Sykes-Picot arrangements in the Middle East, where the British have basically controlled and manipulated that region since the breakup, the intentional targeted breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the renegotiation of the borders in 1916. So, I mean, you really have to go back and look at the historical process that led us to where we are today. I got a report from one of our associates over in Europe, who was saying that one of the big problems when he's dealing with his contacts in the Middle East is the tendency to want to look at, well, who caused this outbreak? Who started it? Which is kind of an absurd question to ask. It's a very provocative question to ask, and you tend to get nowhere except deeper into conflict by asking that question. When you want to ask the question, you say, who caused it? You have to go back to the British, go back to the British imperial arrangements for the Middle East, which are still entirely active. And I know, Michelle, you've done a lot of work in the past on that also.
Right. Well, we have to reiterate it again. I think the first point is the only solution to this is to look to history. And I think among the three of us who have been working on the Middle East for a long time, Marcia Mary Baker here is an expert on the water issue. And I wish she could be brought into our State Department and Commerce Department as soon as we have a new administration or before to lay out the water projects, nuclear desalination, and the cooperation among Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and Syria, and Turkey, because the headwaters from the Turkish area and so forth could actually irrigate all of these deserts and make the desert bloom. But among us, we have been working cumulatively for about 50 years, each of us for decades, and Leandra is, in an isochronic way, been able to capture this in a very, very short time with the LIM. But, let's look at recent history, previous history. The Sykes-Picot Agreement. 1916, in the middle of a war, an unnecessary war, really. But it was World War I, where the conditions were already set for decades because the imperialist powers wanted to block various developments of this crossroads of the world, Southwest Asia, including stop things like the Berlin to Baghdad Railroad, which had already been built from Berlin to Constantinople, and if it had gone down to Baghdad and stayed there, it could have then provided a route to the Persian Gulf, and actually then from there to the Pacific Ocean. This would have been a major blow to the British Empire, if you think about it, because it was the same concept as the Eurasian land bridge. So it was kind of inevitable that the Ottoman Empire, which was very, very overstretched and very backward, the Turkish Islamic Empire was going to probably be defeated in that war. And before even the war was over, France and Britain took out maps. They sucked Russia, pre-Bolshevik, pre-communist Russia, into this deal. And they actually took out maps with, they said, we're going to create a country here. This block here in the desert is going to, we're going to call that something like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, put some tribal chiefs in head of it. This group here, we're going to, around Baghdad, that'll be a country too. And that's going to be under British influence. And this area here, that has a history as a country. And that's going to be, like Syria, France, you can have that and you can have Lebanon. And then, the Palestine, which had already been flooded with Zionist colonizers under the declaration of Lord Balfour. Actually, it was His Majesty's declaration. Balfour just communicated it to Sir Lord Rothschild, who was a big financier of the Zionist homeland and so forth. But the Sykes-Picot idea was to create pseudo-countries that would be under the control of imperial powers, and that these countries would never be allowed to be nation-states. And that is the origin of this hell that that part of the world, and by implication, all of us, have been living through since then. How do we bust that up? Well, the real thing is to bust up the British Empire. Now, the French Empire, which divided it up, you know, has gone through a number of changes, including World War II and President Charles de Gaulle, who was a real Republican leader, and abandoned empire when he gave up Algeria. The British Empire has never done that. They have just shifted their strategy to become a financier empire, and they're in alliance right now with an evil bunch around Prince Bandar bin Sultan of Saudi Arabia, whose father is the defense minister at this point. And Prince Bandar has been Dick Cheney's complete ally in this. The British Foreign Office is chief ally in dreaming up a Sunni bloc that would ally with the warmongers of Israel. And with the warmongers in the United States into an empire faction that would really crush any nationalist nation state aspirations of any country. There's so much to discuss about this, but I want to stay focused on the battle that we of the American Republic have to lead under LaRouche's direction against the British Empire, because one of the big problems with this Gaza war right now is the endless discussion of tiny details as if this crisis started on December 19th, when the leadership of Hamas decided not to renew this very fragile and phony baloney ceasefire to begin with. So let's stay focused on the world crisis and, understand it from that standpoint that the Brits have been having a field day, especially since the Bush administration has come in, and just keeping the Middle East crisis flaring up repeatedly in a situation of perpetual war as another crisis, a far bigger crisis, has been unfolding, which is the collapse of the whole world financial system as we know it. And that would also mean the collapse of modern society as we know it, a modern society based on technology and things that we take for granted, like adequate food, being able to battle disease, and so forth. We're entering a dark age, and this really is the issue, that if we don't solve the crisis from the top, that is a new just world economic system based on the United States' alliance with Russia, China, India as the core issue in the New Bretton Woods, then anything we achieve as a ceasefire or a stopping of fighting in Gaza is just so momentary that it's not even worth discussing.
Let me ask you one thing, Michelle, to bring out, because and also Leandra had a chance with staff to talk to LaRouche today, again, on this strategic focus that you're bringing out. But before we get to that, could you remind listeners, too, when it comes to the threat of peace, that there, despite this miserable decades of Sykes-Picot kind of gamesmanship and thinking and, you know, that kind of where it seems hopeless, you can only tit for tat kind of think of the situation, there were some negotiations for peace between Syria and potentially Lebanon and Israel. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah, and it still is. Look, if this Israeli insanity could be brought under control, and we must all reach out with our thanks, appreciation, and support to the thousands and thousands and thousands of Israelis who are either demonstrating today or trying to demonstrate if they haven't been, you know, shut out by military emergency rule from doing so against this invasion. And it's kind of blacked out in the U.S. media as we expect, but in our discussions with various peace activists and people who you wouldn't think of as peace activists, such as former paratroopers in the Israeli military and so forth. But they are peace activists who are calling on the citizens, the Jewish citizens of Israel, to rise up, make their voices heard, demonstrate, protest, stop this insanity, because life in Israel is becoming unbearable. And one of the things that will happen if they don't have peace is that everybody who can get out of Israel, from the middle class and so forth, interested in educating their children, they don't want to live in a war zone. They will think about leaving and try to get out of that situation if they can't change it. Right now, they can change it. There is a slim majority, but a majority of people in Israel, polls have shown this, who want Israel to make a permanent peace with Syria. And those negotiations have been going on through the intervention, through the mediation of Turkey. And Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, has been traveling from one country to another, from Saudi Arabia to Syria to Egypt and so forth, trying to negotiate a ceasefire. And this was very advanced because earlier this year, the country of Qatar, an oil, you know, a little oil country in the Gulf, took a very significant role through the Arab League and negotiated a peaceful settlement of a crisis in Lebanon in which France played a significant role also by opening the doors and breaking the Cheney Bush rhetoric that we will never deal with Hezbollah. But they opened the doors to Syria's economic cooperation with the Mediterranean Union. And then Qatar, at the very last moment where it looked like everything was dark in Lebanon and a new civil war among the Christians, Sunnis, Palestinians, and Shiites, what could break out again, negotiated held a conference in which the parties themselves negotiated a peace, elected a national unity president, President Sleiman, who also is calling for peace in this situation. And what smart people want is the Palestinians to unify. But this is what Bush, Cheney, the neoconservatives, put their foot down and say, never will we allow Hamas to be recognized in the Palestinian government. So in that sense, we are weakening our ally, President Abu Mazen, whose term ends in 5 days, but he's got an extension till March or April for the elections. But if you have the Israeli army murdering children and women and families the way they have been, using a 1,000-pound bomb on a 4-story apartment building to kill one person. Of course they killed the man's children. Of course they killed his wives. Of course they killed his neighbors. What does a 1,000-pound bomb do? Well, if you hold elections, then the voters are not going to blame Hamas for that bombing. They're going to blame Israel, who dropped the bomb, and the allies of Israel for it. So this hurts us. It hurts the Israelis. And it is a setback to peace. But I believe that with Erdogan, the Turkish leader's activities, and the willingness of the Israeli institutions to seek this peace with Syria, and President Assad and Lebanon both know that this is urgent for their own future survival, this could get back on track. And we would hope, and this is where LaRouche is a visionary, because everybody's saying, oh, now this war throws everything off the table. LaRouche says, no. There's no credible threat of war against Israel. Go for the peace agreement with Syria. An Israel-Syria peace deal would immediately be followed, LaRouche said, by an agreement involving Lebanon. This would dramatically change the dynamic in the entire region and would set the only conditions for a truly just and viable two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. Because if it doesn't happen, there's a certain faction in Israel around Netanyahu and the wise guys like Ehud Barak that think by being tougher than Netanyahu that they're going to win the election in early February. Well, in 1996, Peres thought that he had to be tougher than Sharon, and he lost. In 2000, Barak thought that he could be tougher, and he lost to Sharon. I'm sorry, in 1996, Peres lost to Netanyahu, if I misspoke before. But every time the Labor Party, or now it's the Kadima, et cetera, thought that they could out-Likud the Likud with boots on the ground, they have ended up smashed. They think the Labor Party got down to, like 12 seats in the Knesset. So really, peace is the only option. And the war faction in Israel, which thought that they could only do this during the Cheney-Bush, the end of that, to make a fait accompli, that thinking has to be defeated. So let's get the Syria agreement, break profile, keep that on track, go for it now, go for it immediately, and put our foot down on this military action in Gaza, and we can get it back on track.
Good. And Leandra, you were talking, or you had a chance to discuss things with Lyndon LaRouche earlier today, right? And you might underscore the same. He was talking about the strategic focus we have to have that includes this and in general in the world.
Yes. I mean, in general, there are things that we can immediately do in the Middle East. I mean, one thing is Barack Obama, the afternoon that he's sworn in, could say we're going to start these peace talks up again. And the United States could broker these peace talks. And as Michelle was saying, there are plenty of people in the region who are working very hard to get this peace agreement still. But I mean, that's regional. But in terms of the larger situation, we're on the brink of a dark age situation with the collapse in the financial, the world economic financial system, and these consistent moves into really what people should recognize as a dark age, the wars in Africa, the narco-terrorism in North America, right below our borders, and the situation in the Middle East. But what LaRouche emphasized today is that the United States has to make policy for the world right now, and it has to be LaRouche's policy of the four powers. And the only way we're going to get four powers policy through, we need the grouping of nations to change the world system from the top down. And I mean, the policy has to be to change all the nations in the world, nothing piecemeal, but we need a unified policy. And he emphasized again that, you know, this isn't fun and games. This isn't like everyday policy making. It has to be a revolution, and it has to be with the explicit intention, like in our, like the United States declaring independence. It has to be explicitly against the British Empire. And he said, you know, if you're not out to destroy the British Empire, then you're pretty much wasting your time. So he repeated that we need to create a single fixed exchange rate system, a credit system, and it has to come from the initiative of the United States, Russia, China, and India, and the world is going to follow that. And he said, you know, if we don't get that policy through, then, you know, we can basically kiss civilization goodbye for the next two or three generations to come. But what's very crucial right now is LaRouche's influence in the U.S., the incoming U.S. administration, and then just internationally. And, I mean, we have these webcasts coming up, which are going to be widely, I think probably the most widely viewed of anything he's done up to this point.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that really is, really, really is critical. I mean, think about the national security team that that Obama brought in, which was a big surprise to many of us who have been fighting against the George Soros element in the Democratic Party. You know, Robert Gates has nothing to do with the George Soros Democracy Alliance wing. General Jim Jones in the National Security Council advisor, National Security Advisor, is, you know, a different stripe altogether. And the Soros people hate it. Almost as much as they hate LaRouche, hated Hillary Clinton and did everything to, you know, mock her, humiliate her, break her during the election campaign. And for her to come in as Secretary of State at this point was a victory that I think had almost everything to do with the LaRouche organizing over the previous period, where there was no compromise on Lyndon LaRouche's part, that that Obama could be brought down by the British at any point. And they're trying to set the conditions to, you know, create a fait accompli where he can't. He would not be able to resist the British Empire because of the chaos factor. So it's very, very important to understand this chaos thing. And Leandra, maybe Lyndon LaRouche repeated this today, but I know what he said during the course of the week in dialogue with us working on day-to-day intelligence coverage was, don't look for the explanation of any of these crises in the four corners of the crisis itself. Not the Gaza crisis, not the Mumbai crisis, not the zero interest rate crisis, or the breakdown, breakup of any of these financial institutions, because that is not what is going on. You have to look at it from the overall dynamic. There is no events-driven explanation for these things. Leandra, I know there's been a lot of discussion of that smashing events-driven explanations. Did that come up again in the recent discussions?
Hi, Leandra. I hope our connection is still there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's all right. I just...
yeah.
I know. I heard just what Michelle was talking about this week, too. In other words, don't look for just connections. You know, they say connect the dots. Don't connect the dots.
Gosh,
look at the whole picture.
Right.
But go ahead, Leandra, if you want to.
Well, I don't know if I quite understood the question.
Oh.
Well, what Lynn was saying is that the Mumbai thing came from the British, just the way Gaza did. And while most people are going to look at each of these situations from the standpoint of who caused this immediate crisis, what we have to look at is the overall chaos drive by the British Empire to create an unmanageable world situation so they can prevent the fixed exchange rates and the end of their financial system.
Let me ask both of you one thing on this to draw out this point further that you're making, and Michelle, because one thing is there are capabilities in different places that get detonated. You were on the show in recent weeks about these capabilities that came to the fore to cause the atrocity in Mumbai of the terrorist bombings connected to drug networks, the Saudis. There are capabilities that you referred to earlier in our program now that go back decades.
Right.
And there are capabilities in the Americas, this whole history of narco-terrorism in our own hemisphere. So one thing about that, these capabilities, could you just give one flashback, let's call it that, and take it from longer history up through the present of the way this Zionist movement with this character, Victor Jabotinsky, was put into the scene. Once these borders were drawn all over the map from the, in the whole Southwest Asian region, then the fires were stoked with this Victor Jabotinsky. I think he was born around 1880, and then he becomes a leader of settlement and then a fascist figure. But this is there's a continuity of capability, that's what I'm saying. And now they're being activated around the world.
Right. Well, Jabotinsky was an admirer of Mussolini. And, I've seen him called so many things, Vladimir Jabotinsky, Zev Jabotinsky, Victor.
Oh, I didn't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, all this different. It's all the same person.
Okay.
Jabotinsky is important. Israel, the first Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, actually called him Vladimir Hitler because of his affinity for Mussolini and the fascists. And, look, Jabotinsky is the god of the Likud party. The Likud party wants to come into power. It is the party of Benjamin Netanyahu. And what their charter says, the most recent charter that I could find on the parliamentary website, their parliamentary website, the Knesset website, they actually say that the eastern border of Israel is Jordan, the river, and that there will never be an independent Palestinian state. Now, Netanyahu has very, very close links to the United States. In fact, many of the advisors to Dick Cheney, David Wormser, Scooter Libby, what we called the Straussians, the children of Satan, were very close to Jabotinsky and worked with him through a think tank, which is called the IASPS, I-A-S-P-S, the Institute for Advanced and Strategic and Political Studies. And they wrote a document for Netanyahu in 1996, which they wanted him to deliver when he addressed the United States Congress. Now, he never should have addressed the Congress, since our policy was Oslo and a two-state solution and so forth, and he had a hand in the creation of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who signed the Oslo Accords, because Rabin was killed by a Jabotinskyite, a Jewish fundamentalist radical. And these Jewish fundamentalist terrorists are as much terrorists as anybody on the Palestinian side. But, of course, to even say that there are Jewish terrorists, it brings down an avalanche of criticism against you. But you can't really discuss history accurately if you don't recognize that terrorist capability was deliberately built up. Now, in the coming issue of the EIR and discussing this Sykes-Picot manipulation of the Eastern Mediterranean part of the Arab world, that is the Israel-Palestine situation, we are going to go through the untold story of Tinsky's sponsorship by the British oligarchy, such as the Amory family. And the Amorys, there are several generations of them. I think the most recent well-known person is Sir Julian Amory, but Lord Amory was actually part of the coefficients group with H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell.
So these are the
new dark
evil
age
geopolitical
people.
New dark age on...
Mm-hmm. That's right. And one of our researchers, Steve Meyer, actually has the documents from the coefficients group, which worked with Cecil Rhodes and the famous Rhodes Trust, which had the Rhodes Trust element of the British Empire had as its objective the destruction of the United States and bringing the United States back into the empire. So, this faction of the British oligarchy, they did not want a Jewish political or religious movement that wanted to live peacefully with its Arab neighbors. Rather, they wanted to sponsor a cult of religious warriors who would engage in a perpetual holy war, and this is what we see playing out.
Right, and Leandra, I think you referred to that. People listening, if they haven't already, should go to the LPAC site to see these videos, in particular the one that you did, that's I'm referring to here, about what Israel has to fear is an outbreak of peace. But you were mentioning the British intelligence role in the Muslim Brotherhood and other networks so that they could activate sabotage when they want to. Is that?
Yes, that's definitely a capability.
Yeah, that was something that we covered, I think, back in either 2006 or 2007 after the Lebanon War, when EIR actually put out a short report on the Israeli sponsorship of Hamas, and I guess basically what had happened was Israel had adopted a policy of rather than giving aid toward education, you know, hospitals, these sorts of normal society, normal social institutions. They were funding, you know, mosques, and at the same time, running targeted assassinations of moderate leaders associated with the PLO, and so they were building up a potentially and then eventually fundamentalist grouping, which really falls in line with what you were just talking about, Michelle, with this British apparatus who said, you know, we're not trying to establish a nice Jewish state. We want a region of perpetual warfare.
Exactly.
And I think we also put together this report. A special report, I think, in 2000, with the beginning of the Second Intifada, where EIR put together a whole listing of these insane cults in the region, British originated cults. And I don't know if
Yeah, well, let me say something about that, because I actually brought that that report that Leandra just mentioned into the studio with me. And listeners, I believe it is still available.
Let me give the phone number if you don't have – I mean, those of you hear this also by telephone during the week, and you know that the EIR phone number is 800-278-3135. For the EIR, you can also go online, but call 800-278-3135. Just for the reasons that Leandra and Michelle have said, do it now. Don't wait till January 20. Make it happen, right, that there's a shift. Go ahead.
Right. So the EIR special report, Who is Sparking a Religious War in the Middle East and How to Stop It, is a 170-page report on the cults, on the overworld people, if you will, the British oligarchy, history, the Duke of Kent, the British Freemasonry, etc., the operations in Venice that have actually created this destabilization, and the Second Fada, the Second Resistance Uprising, actually began when Ariel Sharon, former general, notorious general, because in 1982, Sharon had invaded Lebanon, and just after the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, of which Yasser Arafat, the first president of the Palestinian National Authority, was the leader. And the current president, Abu Mazen, it was also one of the early leaders since right after the Israeli-Palestinian War of 1948. Ariel Sharon, as soon as the PLO militias were gone, were driven out of Lebanon by the Israeli army, but protected. The United States Marines was ordered by the United States President Ronald Reagan to protect Yasser Arafat and the leadership of the PLO until they were safely on the boats going to Tunisia that was giving them safe haven. But right after that, Ariel Sharon stood by and escorted, if you will, the Falangist wing of the Lebanese Christians to march into refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, and murder everybody who was there, which is mostly elderly men, women, and children. The estimates go from 800 dead, the very, very minimum, even the Israelis admit that, to 2,000 dead. A total massacre of civilians. And President Reagan was furious. But that very same Ariel Sharon, in the end of 2000, when Clinton, who was very committed, President Bill Clinton was very committed to a peace, Israel-Palestine peace in a two-state solution, a Palestinian state, independent state, was leaving office, Sharon sought permission to take a walk on the Temple Mount, which is the holiest site of Islam. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is up there. And he had 3,000 bodyguards with him. 3,000 bodyguards, and this really, really provoked a very big battle. And already, Palestinian protests, hundreds of Palestinians were shot and killed. Oh boy, we got a really provocative question here coming in. Go ahead, Marcia. We want to read it to us.
Okay, I'm going to ask you. From Virginia, from Mark, he asks if he's missing something, because does Mr. LaRouche expect the Israelis to wave and say hi as the missiles come in? Does Mr. LaRouche consider suicide bombings and missiles not to be threats to Israel?
You are missing something, sir. I'm glad you wrote in with that question. Suicide bombings is the most tragic, horrible tactic ever used, and LaRouche is totally opposed to it. there hasn't been a suicide bombing from Hamas since 2005, and yet the Israelis have refused to talk to them. So when your enemy makes a step in the direction of stopping something that you said was a casus belli, is it not time to talk to them? The missiles. We're not defending the missile strikes on Ashkelon or Sderot. The dropping of 1,000 bombs as direct hits on apartment buildings is not the same thing. And Mr. Walker, please, in your heart of hearts, 8 days of dropping 1,000-pound bombs on civilian centers, the killing of 400 people and the wounding of 2,500 people, in your heart of hearts, if that's equivalent, I don't know what to say to you. Now, during the ceasefire, that Israel said that the bombings of Sderot had just become too much, and they had to undertake this to stop the rocket fire. Actually, that really wasn't an issue. The Israelis violated the ceasefire 153 times from June 2008 to December 19th. Look it up. The United Nations has the records. The United States government has the records. Look it up. It was a phony ceasefire. If you don't have peace, you're going to have war. If you refuse to talk and negotiate and you have a policy, which was the Sharon Olmert policy forced on them by Tony Blair, the whole British Foreign Office, and Cheney, Bush, and the whole neocon, Rumsfeld, etc., and Condi Rice. Don't talk to Hamas. Starve them out, even though they won the election, and Jimmy Carter called it the most fair election he'd ever observed. If you don't take concrete steps for peace, you're going to have this low-intensity warfare. But the real issue is the war plan. And we wrote about this. Mr. Walker, go to go right to the EIR website, LaRouchePub.com. Read LaRouche's statement, "The Only Threat to Israel is an Outbreak of Peace," and read the upcoming EIR article by Jeff Steinberg, which actually includes his entire January 10th, 2008 memo, warning that Israeli factions had begun planning for a bombardment of the Hamas government in Gaza, and the attack would be likely to occur before the end of the year. This was long before the missile barrage.
In fact, Michelle, Leandra mentioned this too. Could you say something about this involvement? You know, he's going to speak on U.S. television tomorrow morning. That'll be January 4th, one of the talk shows. And I wouldn't put him past him to just gloat and go into this and further talk war talk. But could you say about the last year and a half and just what you're describing as organizing for just for what we're seeing playing out now?
Yeah, going back to Mr. Netanyahu and the policy of the neoconservatives, the enemy within, really, a fascist cult inside the United States, from Paul Wolfowitz to Doug Feith, Richard Perle, etc., was a policy called the Clean Break. And the Clean Break said that Israel can only be safe if there is a regime change in Iraq, a regime change in Iran, a regime change in Syria, and to tear up the Oslo and forget about a Palestinian Authority and any discussions of Palestinian state. That's what Clean Break says. And that's what the policy of the Cheney administration has been. So long, long before there were any centrifuges in Iran, the Netanyahu, Cheney, Likud, Wolfowitz policy had to go to war against Iran.
That's like 1996 or so, after the Oslo Accords of 93. I mean, it's a straight sequence.
Forward, yeah. Okay. And it was soon as Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish terrorist, a Netanyahu Sharon supporter, in November 2005. And so the Likudniks decided, hey, this is our moment. We got rid of that that traitor, Yitzhak Rabin, and they went for this.
95, yeah.
In 95. So in 96, they decided with Netanyahu, the new prime minister, they could go for this policy. With Cheney coming back in and the usurping of the U.S. Republic by this Bush administration, you got the adoption of that British plan. Really, it was a British plan. As U.S. policy. And Cheney is going to gloat, and he's going to say that he's going to repeat over and over and over and over the war on terror, 9/11, the global war on terror. We cannot give any space to terrorists and so forth. But what has Israel gained in the 8 years of the Bush administration? They're facing an Iran which is much closer to having nuclear capabilities. They say everything that Iran is doing is towards a bomb. We say no, they're building nuclear power. But as in the case of Iraq, Israel sees any Arab country that has nuclear power as a nuclear weapons threat. So they have that situation. They got absolutely defeated when they tried to take on Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah, which fought the resistance against them, which is an Islamic party, a Shiite Islamic party, they could not defeat them in an asymmetrical war. They had to retreat, had to agree to a ceasefire. And now Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. And so they lost that fight. And instead of facing a Palestinian government of moderates, because of their alliance with this whole Cheney U.S. regime, when there came to a free and fair election, the most radical element among the Palestinians won hands down. They won a fantastic majority. So is Israel safer? Do they have a better economy? No. It is time for peace. And Dick Cheney is one of the most hated people in the world. And the more lurid he is, I think that it will help the cause for peace, because people will understand this guy is dangerous. And I like what Leandra said. Leandra, maybe you can repeat it for our audience. That afternoon, what does Lynn want Obama to do?
On day one? Go ahead, one. Leandra.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. U.S. could broker the peace.
Right. And Michelle, maybe you want to say something we still have the remaining minutes, but over the decades, you've had reason to be conferring with many. I know some of the hydrologists, the Palestinians, who would look to collaborate on day two out of the rubble, which is much worse now and getting worse by the hour. With what we could do, you.
Well, Marcia, let's switch positions here, and I'm going to ask you to comment on the Oasis plan, because one of the most exciting ideas for the entire world is making the desert bloom and how it could actually function, that Israel, Palestine, Egypt, Jordan could collaborate and turn this area from a war zone to a breadbasket and a real cultural renaissance.
Well, one thing is that if you...
I mean, you wrote the book with Lynn on this, I'd say.
If you think of what you said earlier in this program about there were plans to have the railroad, the Germans were building the Berlin to Baghdad railroad and had it down a certain way. And it was a British agent, Lawrence of Arabia, who helped dynamite it. There were also plans at that time for what to do about the fact this is a water-short area. And this is over 100 years ago, 150 years ago. Because, if you're talking about this entire region, look at the Jordan River. It's famous in history. It's famous to many religions. It's famous in the Bible, but it's very tiny. There's really not much there. So what you have to do is make best use of it, but it was really too little water, certainly as of the 1920s, let alone today. And you could, of course, capture any rainfall or snow and dam it up and build Lake Tiberias, Sea of Galilee, as it may be called. You could do all these kinds of things, but then after the Second World War, it was a priority on the entire planet to desalinate the handy seawater that's in the Mediterranean or the nearby Gulf of Aqaba.
Just this week, Jordan was working on feasibility studies. We don't have much time, but maybe you can just describe that one project, the Med-Dead Canal, the Mediterranean to Dead Sea Canal. That's what the Jordanians were discussing.
Right. So, and this, there are maps of this going back 150 years that if you dug a channel from the Mediterranean Sea eastward into the Jordan Basin, as it's called, where where there's a big drop, because you're dealing with a fault line. It goes all the way through Southwest Asia down through Eastern Africa, you know, into the famous lake region. So if the seawater comes, you can bring the seawater from the Mediterranean into the Jordan Basin. As it falls, you have made yourself a handy waterfall, and you can generate electric power simply from hydropower, and that's without even getting into strategic siting of nuclear power plants, which gives you a lot more capability. But the Jordanians reiterated just in the last 10 days, I think, that this should go ahead, a completely different pathway for people in the region than this strife and carnage that's been triggered by this tired old British play everyone off against each other operation. And, you know, if you did this Mediterranean Red Sea, or Dead Sea, excuse me, in the Jordan Basin, Mediterranean Dead Sea Canal, that's one thing. And you could also improve things to go from the Dead Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba to the south. And it's very calculable. If you built merely 10 to 20 nuclear power plants in the region, you can duplicate all the water that naturally is in the Jordan River Basin on an annual basis anyway.
Wow.
So you would create your new Jordan River. It doesn't mean it has to be in the same place. It just means that's the volume of water that you could provide to this region. Now, some of the best hydrologists in the world are Palestinian and Israeli. So the basis of collaborating on this kind of project exists in practical fact. It's just a question of ending this, what Leandra, I think, called the Sykes-Picot game mentality, that you have to be stuck in the game. Who shot who first? What's happening? Who's blowing up who? No, that's just a complete ideological trap. So there are no limits to the resources. The technology exists, and this was discussed in 1993 when the Oslo Accords came to pass, and they were thwarted by the institutional form of this brutish empire working through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. They said, you can't do any of this. It's impractical. Instead, go for something practical. Go for scuba diving and coral reefs, and go for resort hotels and casinos. And then it was just squashed.
Well, this OASIS plan was Lyndon LaRouche's first initiative that I remember back in 1976. And this is what we can do with the new Bretton Woods.
And we have only a final few seconds, but this is what could begin, as Leandra said, on day one of the Obama administration, if we're going to build peace and stop making war with the brutish empire game plan. So let me thank Leandra Bernstein, who's in the LaRouche Political Action Committee editorial department, and Michelle Steinberg here in the studio with me with EIR News Service. And I especially want everyone to tune in January 11th, 2009. This will be on the way to LaRouche's new international webcast. That's January 22nd and January 16th. And I thank everyone. Happy New Year. Let's make it so.
Okay.
Thank you.